Und hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Datengarten Nummer 89. Unser heutiger Talk wird auf Englisch gehalten, von daher werde ich jetzt auch einfach mal completely random to English switching. This is worse. This sucks. Let's do it from the beginning. Hello and welcome. Welcome to our talk, to our sessions, Datengarten number 89 here in the CCCB headquarters in Berlin. We have a very special guest for you tonight. Please welcome and welcome for a huge applause. A huge applause for our speaker, Kashay Keshab. Perfect. And he will be talking about software-defined networking and flaws in software-defined networking. And he's a security researcher here at Technische Universität. Okay, and later we will have a short Q&A session where you all can ask questions, and to have these questions on the stream and on the recording, I will come to you, and please wait until you have the microphone to actually state your question. So, but this is for it for now. I wish you all much fun, and please welcome Keshab.
All right, thank you. So just one quick question. So can the audience ask questions during the talk also?
Or I guess so.
All right, cool. So you maybe have to take the mic. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. Thank you everybody for having me here, and thank you for attending my talk. As Matthias mentioned, my name is Keshab Temaraju. Before I begin, just like to briefly introduce myself. It's the first time here, so it's really nice to be here. Thanks to Starbucks, who invited me. And so I started my bachelor's in the sunny west coast of South India. And I worked for Juniper Networks for about 4 years after my bachelor's. 2 years in India, 2 years in the US. And I worked on the routers and firewalls over there. And then after that, I had a brief stint with chemical photography, which inspired me to go and do my master's, actually in computer science. And then now I'm doing my PhD at TU Berlin. So I've worked in the networking industry and academia, and so it seemed natural for me to work in software-defined networking. So before I start, just quick show of hands here. How many of you have heard about SDN, at least? Okay, wow. Okay. Okay, this is a little surprise. I didn't expect everybody. So then I can skip a few things. So I'm assuming then people are also familiar with networking, also some of the concepts. Okay, cool. So I can skip quite a bit. So let's start. Okay, so this is the outline I have. I wanted to talk about some of the networking concept, but I assume all of you already know a lot about it. So maybe we can just breeze through that. And then I'd like to just give you a short story on how we got to SDN. And then after that, we look at some concepts or the basics of SDN, and then look at some attacks and defenses in software-defined networking. Okay, so just quickly a big recap. If you've taken a computer networking course, what was like the most basic or the first thing they teach you over there? Any answers? Okay, the protocol, something just a little more basic, just a little more basic. IP, okay, so layers. So TCP/IP model, right? So if you take a networking course, they're going to say, this is the TCP/IP model, and then you have all these layers and stuff. And so each layer is supposed to be independent of the other layer, right? So just quickly go through this. We have the data link layer, right? So we're doing Ethernet. Here's the photo of a big Cisco box with a lot of ports, about 192 ports over there. Like you mentioned, VLAN, STP, all that stuff. We do forwarding based on MAC addresses in the data link layer. Then we have a big beefy router over here, a Cisco SR. And this is based on IP addresses. So this is the network layer, right? And we run our routing protocols like RIP, BGP, OSPF, all that stuff that operates on the networking layer, right? And then we have firewalls. So this is typically on the TCP or UDP layer. So you're looking at ports and also IP addresses, and then you decide to either send packets based on, or block packets based on a combination of addresses and ports. And you can do this either based on some state or stateless. Right? And then you have all these other devices like load balancers and optimizers and stuff like that. We won't look at that so much now. So one last concept that we need to quickly go through over here is the control plane and data plane. So in the control plane, you typically run your routing protocol, for example. So that's an application running on an operating system. Could be Linux, Solaris, FreeBSD, but they're all running on some general purpose CPU, so that's important. So this is running in the control plane. General purpose CPU, very slow, computes routes and installs those routes in the data plane. And so the data plane is typically, at least high performance data planes, is using an ASIC or an NPU or could be an FPGA, right? And so you can do like high-speed packet processing, so at line rate, from one port to the other. And so for the most time, and even now, if you look at any big networking device, it's really it's like a tightly coupled control plane and data plane. So it's like software written for the hardware. They're proprietary, closed. Okay, of course, you have Linux and all that stuff. But if you buy like a Cisco box or a Juniper or whatever, it's all like proprietary. It's closed, so you can't really play around with it that much, changing the source code. It's quite complex. It's also difficult to manage, right? So anybody actually working as a network admin over here or operating networks? So I'm assuming it's quite a challenge, right? At least the configuration and stuff like that. And so software-defined networking essentially tries to address these points of having this distributed control plane with proprietary software and hardware and sort of the complexity of operating and managing networks. So let's just go back in time to the 90s and then see how we got here and what actually brought software-defined networking into a reality. All right. So we'll start with the 90s. But before that, we have just, I made a sort of overview over here. So, is that from my mic or? Okay. I don't know. Sorry. Okay. So we talk about, is it on? It is? Okay, cool. So we start with the 90s and then, okay, there's 2020 here. I mean, we are not yet in the 2020s, but slight prediction. But we'll cover these sort of topics from a high level and then look at SDN, right? So although packet switch networks started off in the 60s and 70s, and the ARPANET started to grow in the 80s, it was only in the 90s that service providers started to actually build their networks, and the internet actually started to take off in the mid-90s, so like in the 95 or something, when e-commerce websites like Amazon and eBay and Yahoo entered the market, right? And so at this time, people were still using dial-up connections into the internet, and people who were creating or managing these services had a lot of ideas, and it was pretty hard to actually sort of experiment with their ideas. So even if they were able to actually say, test out an idea, getting it out into production was pretty much a nightmare. So you'd have to go through like this whole standards process. I mean, I've not been to an IATF meeting or a standardization process, but from what I hear, it's a pretty long and excruciating process where you're like pulling hair from each other, saying, hey, no, I want to do it like this. No, I want to do it like this, but that person's doing it like that. Why can't we do it like that? So you could imagine it's not so, I'd say, easy to get something out there. And then what they actually then came up with was this idea called active networking. So the idea was to dynamically affect the network processing and state to avoid ossification, so to avoid being stagnant. And so they came up with these two models called the capsule model and the programmable router model. And so for a reason that's probably obvious with the capsule model, why it did not succeed is because they wanted to actually have code.
Oh, no worries.
Sorry.
Just let me just stand here uncomfortably and close near to you.
Okay.
But yeah, let's fix this audio
thingy
snafu.
Okay.
So just keep it there. It should work.
Okay.
So thank you for your patience.
Okay. Thanks for that. So like I was mentioning, the capsule model for a good reason didn't take off because they wanted to actually execute code that would be present in untrusted network packets. And the idea was to place some Java code in there, and then a router could process that code and then say, oh, you experienced some delay previously. I'm going to like reroute you. So they wanted to do some kind of fancy congestion control. And then there was the programmable router model, where they wanted to expose an interface to the router so that they could sort of get to know what resources are utilized by the router. Again, this was to handle some kind of congestion control. These ideas, although they may seem sort of controversial with respect to security, these are ideas that were there in the 90s, and it's actually only now that we can have or expose like queuing delays on every interface to some centralized, say, controller, and actually do a lot of debugging using what's called P4 and the PISA switch. But that's another talk altogether. And so, unfortunately, in the 90s, or with this active networking, it didn't really take off. So, you know, there wasn't enough pull from the industry, and people were like, oh, no, I don't know, this has a lot of issues, maybe performance, maybe security, maybe a whole bunch of other things. And so time went forward, and then service providers started to lay down a lot more cables. So here's a map where we can see the world is pretty well connected, right, in the 2000s already. And if we look at a big US service provider, AT&T, their network was pretty big as well. I mean, these are OC48 links. So that's 2.5 gigabits per second. You may like smirk at that right now. What's that? I mean, and they had only two OC192 links. So that's 10 gig. They had two 10 gig links. I mean, now you get network cards with 10 gig. I mean, your desktop or whatever can have 10 gigs. So this is back in the day almost. And so nonetheless, these networks are pretty big. And so operating and controlling these networks were crucial, right? However, it was quite a nightmare for a lot of these people. You needed to have immense technical skills. You needed to know you need to have like a lot of experience and know-how about a particular, say, router. And then forget about like interop, say, a Cisco and Juniper box. That's already quite a huge task to deal with. And so what people thought of doing was separating the planes, right? And so the idea over here was with forces, that's RFC 3746, was to have some open interface between the control plane and the data plane. So imagine running a Juniper operating system on Cisco hardware or the other way around. And so they wanted to have this open programmable interface that one could use to sort of interop between hardware and software, or rather the control plane and data plane. I mean, again, over here, the idea was good, but the timing was not right, and there was not enough, say, momentum by the industry, right? They still wanted to keep everything closed, like, oh, if I open this up, they're going to eat into my market share. I can't do that. That's not good for business. And so eventually, by post-2005 or 2010, you have this sort of perfect storm brewing. And that sort of introduced what's called OpenFlow and SDN. So if anyone's wondering, I mean, so I attended this SDN conference earlier this year, and then they made this a really big deal as to who came up with the term software-defined networking and stuff. And so this MIT review author was the one who actually coined the term, supposedly. So that's why I put this up there. And it didn't come up by some professor or anything. It was during an interview with a professor that they came up with this. I mean, nonetheless. So this was sort of the perfect storm. And with this, people could now have this open interface between the control plane and data plane. And that's what they call OpenFlow, right? And they also have the separation, or rather the consolidation of the control plane. So why have this fully distributed control plane when you can just like make life so much easier by having it centralized? And that's what sort of this whole software-defined networking paradigm is all about in some sense. And to also generalize the packet processing, so this whole match action paradigm was introduced in this work and the papers that followed from them. And lastly, it also introduced this blur between a switch, a router, a firewall, a load balancer, because these switches could now look at MAC addresses, look at IP addresses, look at ports, and do some kind of load balancing as well. So you have everything in one sort of network element, right? And at the same time, you also have network virtualization, right? So around the time of OpenFlow and SDN, the cloud computing industry was also growing. And as the cloud started to grow, you have all these virtual machines, right, running in servers. And then you have this infrastructure as a service cloud model where I can rent a whole bunch of VMs and create my own network in the cloud. And then you can go and create your virtual network. And so then it became important to be able to manage and control these networks. And so that's why you have this whole virtual switch. Open vSwitch. Anyone heard of Open vSwitch over here? Okay, cool. So that's sort of also the motivation for Open vSwitch in some sense. And they actually implemented OpenFlow. And so in some sense, they sort of, the timing was right, where it's like this virtual switch that implements OpenFlow and is just perfect for SDN and network virtualization. And also, there was something called network function virtualization. So this is, again, sort of this whole softwareization, where why buy this super expensive hardware box when you can just run it as an application or run it in a VM, right? So commodity servers, cheap. Commodity NICs are cheap. Why not just do everything in some general purpose server? And this was also sort of driving the whole softwareization of networks. And so that sort of enters into sort of like the 2015 onwards, what we call now network softwareization. So everything just folds in. You have SDN, you have network virtualization, you have NFV, all these buzzwords, and P4 just like all merge into what we call network softwareization. And I think the last piece of this whole sort of shift in networking with respect to SDN is what's called P4, so this protocol independent programmable packet processors, right? So what OpenFlow lacked was this flexibility to describe what the data plane or your match action model should be like, and that's sort of what P4 addresses to some degree, right? And it's also this, they introduced this new switching architecture called the Protocol Independent Switch Architecture, or PISA, where you can sort of on the fly change what your tables can match and operate on. This is again, yeah, like just another talk altogether, P4. So I won't go into that so much, except we can talk about it offline, or if you have any questions, we can talk about it then. So just to summarize all this and put this all into perspective, we had old networks or traditional networks, which have a distributed control plane and running their own applications on there. And that's pretty hard to manage, sort of transform into this separated control plane. I mean, the separation between the data plane and control plane, and sort of this consolidation of the control plane into this centralized sort of plane that's easy to manage. All right. And so just let's look at that a little more closely. So like I mentioned, it's the separation of the planes. So this is where OpenFlow comes into the picture. So there's this standard protocol that you can use. So it doesn't matter now whether you have a Juniper box or say, I don't know, an HP switch or a Force 10 or whatever. If it supports OpenFlow, you can write your own, say, application that speaks OpenFlow and then run it on whatever hardware you want that supports OpenFlow again. And it's also the centralization of the controller. So now you don't need to have this whole distributed control plane and waiting for them to converge on some, on the similar view of the topology. You have a global view from a central, what they call logically centralized control plane. And this makes networking kind of easier in some sense. So now you can do a few different things that you couldn't do. So I have a couple of videos to show you what you could do with this sort of centralization. And also, it's not just centralization. You could have multiple controllers, so you could have a distributed control plane. But it just makes it easier if you have something centralized. And then is this open and programmable forwarding model. So, I mean, as far as I understand, and when I was at Juniper, they were also doing match action. I mean, it's not something unknown, this open, this forwarding model of matching on headers and performing some actions. It's just that OpenFlow made this open. So everyone knows this is what we're going to be able to do, and this is how we, these are the headers we handle, these are the actions we perform. And so over here is sort of like an image that shows you what the first OpenFlow protocol could support. So you have like a bunch of header fields, and then you perform some kind of action. So you can forward, you can send it to the controller or the control plane. Maybe you could drop, or you could even sort of rewrite fields in the header as well. So that's this modified field. All right. And so finally, we have network virtualization. So with this centralized controller or control plane, you can now, since you have a global view, you can sort of abstract the physical resources into multiple logical pieces, right? And then you can so operate on this or give this piece off to someone else to operate on. And you can enforce some kind of isolation. So now it's important that this centralized controller has some kind of isolation enforcement. And to think of it in a little more, if you think about it in the future, you could also then do this recursively. And so far, it hasn't caught up in the industry yet. And you don't see so much momentum over there. But if you think of it, this controller, this control plane now represents, say, this virtual network, right? You could then recursively send this up to another controller. So this could be your now data plane that could go to another controller and then sort of recursively go and do that. The use case, I mean, there are certain use cases, but hasn't caught up yet. That's still very advanced stuff. So These are essentially like the main concepts of software-defined networking. So you may be wondering now at this point, who's really using SDN? Is this really, useful in some sense? And the answer is there are quite a few people using SDN, or at least going with the SDN flow. And preparing for these slides, I tried to be a little like local. I try to also buy some local things, so I try to find some local Berlin, made in Berlin SDN stuff, and I'll show you a couple of things on that right now. So first off, I need to mention like the big players who have like billions of dollars who can afford to do stuff like this, which is like Google, of course, and we have Microsoft Azure, right? And so I'm not sure how many people have seen some of the videos by Google, but more or less every other year you have Amin Vahdat coming up and like just like showing off what they've done in their whole data center or with their network. So starting with their internal data center and then talking about the WAN and stuff like that. And so they use SDN, they also use OpenFlow, and now they're also pushing P4. So they're clearly driving sort of the networking industry and research and all that. And then you have as well as Microsoft Azure. So they've also been doing it for at least 12 years now. There are a couple of talks at Usenix conference called NSDI. If you're really interested, I'd suggest you watch them. They're pretty cool. And then, of course, not only made in Berlin, but made in Germany. We have Deutsche Telekom also offering this open cloud. So they use OpenStack, and that's also sort of an SDN, uses the SDN concepts. So these are big cloud providers. You also have private data centers. So I listened to a podcast for SDN, actually, Open vSwitch's creator, one of the creators from Open vSwitch, Ben Pfaff. He has a podcast called OVS Orbit. And just to get a couple of instances of where else SDN is being used, I have this sort of screenshot. I don't think you can see it that well here, but it says SDN. I tried to highlight it. So this is in eBay. And then you also have Huawei, also using SDN, building SDN stuff. And then this I thought was pretty interesting. So the Berlinale leases their, say, network from Colt Networks. And so Colt actually uses SDN to sort of dynamically provision bandwidth for the Berlinale. So the network for Berlinale is pretty, it's not active for the most part of the year. And then as soon as I think people start to send in their films, they need to handle a lot more bandwidth. And then as that progresses into the actual film festival where they need to send out the films to the different kinos, the bandwidth requirements change. And so they use SDN to sort of dynamically manage this, resource allocation in some sense. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. At least you have something used for a film festival in Berlin. So, and then you have like a wide area network. So this is another company called VeloCloud. When I was working with T-Labs for a short time, we had to work with this solution, VeloCloud. They do SD-WAN, so that's software-defined wide area networking. Essentially, you get a box, you put it in your office, and then you get another box and put it in another office. And then they have some kind of centralized controller or a distributed data plane that sort of just connects the two together, and you can manage it from a nice GUI. This company got bought for a few billion, I think, recently by VMware, and they're debating whether that was really worth it or not. And yeah, again, you can see Deutsche Telekom over here, and then a couple of other companies also using it. And then this is what I was talking about, made in Berlin. So there's the Berlin Institute of SDN, and they do SDN stuff, so actually high-performance networking, mainly in the data plane. They also write software for the control plane. And they have a meetup, so it's called the SDN NFV meetup. If you're interested, I'd suggest you go. I've been going to a few of them. Some of them are pretty interesting. People give good talks. So I just thought I'd share this also with you. So I don't know, maybe you've already thought of this by now, but there are several challenges with SDN, not to forget security, which is the focus of this talk. You have scalability issues. So how many switches can like a single controller handle, for example, or how many controllers can you actually have in a whole distributed control plane, for example? What about the reliability issues between the control plane and data plane? Then consistency. So not only consistency between the control plane and data plane, but if you have multiple controllers, you want them to be consistent as well. They should have a consistent view of the network. And then you have performance issues, right? So does this actually make my network slow? Does it take longer for packets to go from the data plane to the control plane and back? Flexibility issues, so programming and interop. So can I use, say, one controller software and another controller software, and would they work with the same data plane, for example? And most importantly, at least for me, it's the security issues of SDN, and I think there are quite a few. I mean, this talk has more attacks, at least I prepared for a few of those, more attacks than defenses in SDN. So with that, let's look at some of the attacks. Before that, any questions so far? Any, I don't know, clarifications, yeah?
1 second, I'm right over here.
Just like really basic, is it replacing the operating systems which are running on the hardware? Did I understand that correctly? Mm-hmm. That you replace every differences you have in your hardware with one big super operating system which controls your whole network?
Not really. So what they would do, at least for OpenFlow, is simply add like an OpenFlow agent or just another OpenFlow service that you'd enable that can allow you to speak OpenFlow. Does that answer your question? So you don't need to change the operating system as such. So if you look at, I'm sort of biased also towards Juniper, because I work there and I know a little bit about it. They have Junos as their operating system. And so they also support OpenFlow, as far as I understand. And so do a whole bunch of other people. And all they have to do is simply have some sort of interface that you can communicate with, and then they sort of map that into whatever they have. But if you look at Open vSwitch, that's a software switch that doesn't change the hardware as such. So does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? No? Okay, cool. So let's get started. This is like a non-exhaustive list of some of the attacks. Here's sort of a figure that shows potential vulnerabilities within SDN. This is work done by some folks in, if I'm not mistaken, KAIST in South Korea. And they've published a lot of work, not only CVEs, but also research papers. And today I'd like to talk about at least these four attacks. So you have topology poisoning. So think of something like, I don't know, spoofing your LLDP packets or ARP poisoning, for example. And then we have teleportation. So I'm sort of also shamelessly talking about some of the work that I've done as well. So that would be teleportation. And then you have reconnaissance. So some kind of, you could say also timing analysis, or sending a bunch of packets and sort of reconstructing what the configuration of certain boxes are. And then you have packet parsing exploits. I mean, this is like classic stuff. I think FX also talked about this, and I think this is just getting worse with SDN. And then you have classic denial of service attacks, and then persona hijacking. As far as I understand, persona hijacking is a glorified form of ARP poisoning in some sense. You not only attack the MAC address, IP address, you take everything else after that. And then you have race conditions. So sort of events, you sort of try to inject some kind of packet in between or trigger certain conditions in the network at the controller. So let's look at topology poisoning. So I have some videos for you, so it's not just me going to talk. Some other people have spoken, and I just shared that with you. And in this attack, the position of the target can be manipulated, or you can actually fake links in the network. So let's see. Hopefully this works. I tested this out. Okay. So this video doesn't have any audio, so I'm going to talk. Hopefully you should be able to see that text. Can you all see that? Read it? Could we dim the lights a bit? Is it possible? Better? Oh, yeah, thank you. Okay, so what in this video, it's about 2 minutes, right? So I'm just going to quickly tell you what's going on while the script, whatever they're running. So they're going to start the controller. If I didn't make this clear, the control plane, we also call it the controller, right? And so in this case, they're using the Open Daylight controller. And so they're going to start that. This is it starting. All bunch of like Java stuff going on. Okay, launch. Okay, so now they launched it. Now they're going to run a mininet with two switches, essentially. So mininet is this framework that you can use to do like rapid prototyping. So you can run OpenVSwitch, which is like the de facto software switch you'd use if you want to try out any sort of SDN idea you have. And you'd use mininet to create a topology of these different switches and plug in your, say, OpenFlow controller in there, right? So that's what they're doing here. Okay, this is the CLI commands. And it's so strange, they give us their public IP address in this like public video. It's kind of funny. I haven't tried connecting to that controller yet. Okay, so they're going to run that switch. Okay, it started. And now, so now this is sort of the GUI of that controller. Right? Most likely default credentials. Okay, so that's sort of the topology they have, right? Two switches. And so now what they're going to do is they're going to add a switch into this whole topology. All right? Okay, types really slow. So it started that third switch, essentially. And now we'll see that switch pop up in there. Right, so it refreshed. And so now you have that third switch, and there's no link, right? The switch is sort of independent. Now they're going to send like a packet from one of the hosts. So one of the hosts is connected to that switch. It sends, I think it's sort of this spoofed LLDP packet that they send out using Scapy, of course. Right? So now they send it. And then now they check back at the controller, and then the controller thinks there's a link between that switch. So that's sort of like from a host. Imagine you're connected in your office, and then you sort of do this. That's pretty crazy. You're faking the network. Oh, could we keep it down? Because I'm going to play a bunch of videos now. So that was topology poisoning. I mean, interestingly, there were like, at this conference, NDSS, there were two papers that sort of talk about topology poisoning together. Then there's teleportation. This is some work that I've done with a few of my colleagues, actually. And the idea is to exploit the centralized controller over here. And this is sort of also based on the assumption that these switches are actually compromised or malicious. So this is sort of the threat model we work with, that the switches are compromised. This is sort of inspired by the Snowden leaks, where you have like switches that could be backdoored, or you can even like sort of compromise these switches because of software issues, for example. And so the idea is that a switch sends a message to the controller. The controller receives this, and it sends out one or more messages to one or more switches. So essentially, you can transfer data from this switch through the controller to this switch. You don't go through the data plane at all. So you can bypass, say, firewalls in the middle. Or you can even sort of imagine you have, like, this is sort of a toy example. You have, like, the Prüfungsamt, and then you have your student dorm. And the students sort of have infiltrated those switches in the Prüfungsamt and in their dorm, and now they want to secretly exfiltrate the grades or the exams. And so then they can sort of go through the data plane, go through the control plane rather than being blocked by some physical disconnection or firewall. So I have a couple of videos to show this. And actually, there are like a few ways. We identified at least three or four different ways you can do this. And I'll probably play like two of them to you. Let's see. Okay, so here's the first one. So this is sort of the topology we have. There's a firewall in between and two switches. And this firewall sort of blocks traffic between these two switches. Okay, so I'm trying to show that with my mouse over there. Right, so. So I'm going to just quickly start up that mininet script, right? That's what I was talking about. And then open up console to the firewall. Can you read that in the back? You just have to believe me now. So I'm just going to set up like the firewall rules over there. So essentially saying drop IPv4 packets here, okay? So we can see the count is zero, right? Packet count zero on the firewall. And those packets are allowed, those LLDP, just so that we can actually see the topology in the GUI. Right, so now I start the controller. This will take some time. The controller starts up. Okay, now I also log in with default creds over here. And so now we can see these two switches. We don't see the firewall, as that's not like an SDN firewall as such. Right, so we have these two switches. And so now there's sort of this app that inserts, say, these flow rules. Sorry, I forgot to mention this flow rule. So forwarding rules into the switch that allows for connectivity. Also, we just have to make the controller aware of the different hosts that are in this network. And so now we'll see those hosts pop up over here, right? Okay, so now we ping H1 to H2, so this way. And that should go through fine. Okay, that takes 10 seconds. Okay, so now we look at the switch and then look at the rules in there, so we can see that it's inserted flow rules or forwarding rules based on the port and MAC address, right? So this is on this switch. And so now what I'm going to do is, what am I going to do? Now I'm going to go from, so from this host, I'm going to go directly to this host, rather bypass the firewall. So the packet will go like this through the controller, then the controller will send it here and then go here, right? And so we got to do a little, one small trick here. We just need to send those packets very fast. So not like 1 second, one packet per second. And so we can see these packets go through, right? So actually, the firewall policy says these packets should not, but we were actually able to ping that host and receive the reply. So over here, I'm just trying to show you. So on the right is Wireshark, obviously. And this is sniffing the TCP connection or that OpenFlow connection between those two switches to the controller, right? And so what I want to show you here is that those ping packets are actually going through those connections up there. And essentially by matching this port number with that Ethernet packet, right? So you can see this ping request has that source port, and this ping request like this, then like this, matching those ports with those particular switches. Right? And so we can also see that in the flow rules. We can see this in the firewall rule on the firewall table that the packet count is zero. So no packets hit that firewall. And then now I just quickly show you, I try to ping again, and then that doesn't sort of go through. Because the controller actually installed flow rules on the switch, and that sort of drops all the packets over there. Right? So this is one. So this was actually using one technique, which we call out-of-band forwarding. How do I close this? There's another technique which we called switch identification teleportation. So this is sort of a different technique. And this was done by one of my master's students. And essentially, this is like a covert channel. So the switches try to connect to the controller, but they use what's called a data path identifier. So in this SDN network, you have switches. They need to identify themselves to the controller. And that's using what's called a data path identifier, or DPID. And so what we discovered is that if you have two switches using the same DPID, you can sort of create this covert channel. So first one switch connects with one DPID, and then the other switch tries to connect with that same DPID. And so depending on whether it gets disconnected or it connects, you can sort of decipher whether it's a zero or one. And if you do this, like if you modulate this sort of behavior, you can covertly transfer information. And so in this video, what he's doing is we made this into a script, and we can send like a text message from one switch to the other via the controller. And essentially, so he wants to send this string, so network softwareization. And so he sort of maps it into ASCII and then sends it in sort of frames of 7 bits or 8 bits. And so on the right, you can see like the whole messages that are actually being thrown at the controller, where it says, oh, connected, error, disconnected, same switch with same DPID kind of thing. And so this goes on for, this whole length of the video. And that's what I wanted to show you. And then at the end, so it's getting to the end almost. So let's see, IO. So here, that's N. Over here, we're sending letter N. And then we'll notice that, so this channel doesn't have error correction. So we actually send network softwareization with a small r. But due to some errors in this sort of channel, we get a capital R. But essentially, at least we got the whole text. So this we thought was pretty cool, actually. So these were like two of those teleportation techniques. Oops, what is this? Right. So that's teleportation, right? And this is sort of novel. This isn't there in your traditional networks where you have this whole distributed control plane. It works good with a centralized control plane. And then we have reconnaissance. So this is also quite interesting because as a host, you can now sort of send packets. If you choose your packets carefully, you craft these packets in a certain way, you can sort of infer what the flow rules on the switch are. And so there's this video that actually does that. There's a whole paper also on this. So how come the, can you see that the quality is not so good yet, right? So what he's doing here is, I'm hoping that the tech, okay, it's better, right? Yeah. So in this video, essentially what he's trying to show you is that by sending packets, he can figure out what the configuration on the switch is. And imagine you have a firewall that blocks your IP address. So if you can figure out what rules there are and what IP addresses it's blocking, you can sort of send a packet with a different IP address and get past that firewall. And that's sort of what he tries to demonstrate over here. So this is sort of the firewall rule. So he's saying, drop this source and this destination, drop them. And so this is configured at the controller that then pushes those rules down to the switch. Okay. So he tries to ping, and the ping doesn't succeed. So this sort of flow rule is enforced. This firewall rule is enforced. So this is actually his sort of analysis. So it's first checking with TCP. Yeah, I'm sorry, I think that text is not so sharp also. Even I can't really read it. but this analysis runs for some time that allows me to drink some water. And I mean, we don't have to watch the whole thing. But he sends out like a bunch of packets, so with different headers and potentially different addresses as well, that can then be used to deduce what the actual flow rules are. And so now he says the analysis is okay, it's not yet done. So he's checking with different IP address, MAC addresses. And so here he was actually able to reconstruct the flow rules. And so that's essentially the firewall rules, the drop rules. And now that, say, this is the attacker, that the attacker knows what these rules are, she can simply sort of adapt the attack to her needs. So now you can simply use a different IP address and contact, say, that private web server that you want. And so now you just change the IP address to 10.0.0.11, and you can reach that destination. See? And so the ping goes through. It's pretty crazy. There's other work also. So this is based on active probing. You can also do some kind of like a little more passive by measuring the time it takes to go and come back. That's also another piece of work, so reconnaissance attacks. And then we have good old packet parsing exploits. Like I mentioned, FX, who also did some work on this, especially with Cisco boxes, Cisco routers. And so I think a few days back, I just Googled like malformed packet crashes. So typically you have vendors, networking vendors would not just say it's like a packet parsing issue, but some malformed packet crashes that box. And so we can already see over here, this is my mouse, crash malform, batch of malformed, Cisco bug, CDP crashes, Cisco bug, ASR router crash with malformed, test case crashes, Wireshark. So all this has to do with parsing packets. And essentially, implementing these parsers is highly error-prone, as they're done manually more often than not. And so over here, we can also see TCP dump, for example. So, and this was pretty funny because one of my colleagues also was involved with reporting some of these CVEs. So you have 2007, number of vulnerabilities 2. And then 2017, 10 years later, You have like 133 vulnerabilities reported. That's crazy. I mean, what happened in these 10 years, right? So they've most likely introduced so much parsing code in there. I mean, if you use TCP dump, it's all about parsing packets and then printing what those headers and payloads are. And so imagine you're a network admin, you're running TCP dump on one of your interfaces, and you have like 100 vulnerabilities over there. And if someone, some random guy in your network just sends this packet and potentially gets a remote code execution on that system, you're pretty much owned over there. So, and these reports, I mean, several people actually reported this. And it's quite interesting, I thought, like all this sudden surge. And you can see overflow, there are so many overflows, 131. I'm not sure if they're all buffer overflows. And then you have at least three remote execute code. So that's pretty, you know, pretty scary stuff. The same thing happened with OpenFlow as well. So my colleague and I also reported a few vulnerabilities with OpenVSwitch. Yeah, we reported these two CVEs, and we were quite lucky to have found a remote code execution with OpenVSwitch. And so, as a result, from a virtual machine, so OpenVSwitch is typically running in your, say, hypervisor, or your virtualization, your DOM0 hypervisor. And so if you send a packet from a VM, it goes to OpenVSwitch, and then if you send this specific crafted packet, you get a root shell on that system. And then you can, you patch, and then you can propagate to all the other servers in, say, this SDN-based cloud. And essentially, you have root on all of them. And this was pretty exciting work, actually. Oops. And so we wrote a paper about that, and then we reported it to the developers as soon as we found it, and they were actually very understanding and helpful, and they patched immediately, and then they responded also quickly and stuff like that. So one of the reasons why this was also feasible is because the fact that in, say, OpenFlow or in SDN, now they want to parse, like I mentioned, right, this functionality is blurred. So it's a switch, it's a router, it's a firewall, it's a load balancer. So they have to parse all these protocols, and these protocols are increasing over time. And so with every new protocol you add, your chance of introducing a bug or a vulnerability increases. And that's sort of what we sort of say and observe with SDN in particular. And so I have this sort of graphic that shows you that. So you start from a VM, you send that packet over there, you own OVS. So from a compute node, this is with OpenStack, for example. Anyone used OpenStack over here? OK. So you have compute nodes. On these compute nodes, you run your virtual machines. And then you have the centralized controller node, right? And so from this controller node, you can sort of configure all your compute nodes, essentially. And you run your controllers or some kind of application in different VMs. And this essentially shows how you can sort of propagate a worm from one, starting from a VM and going to the controller, and due to the centralized nature, going to all the other servers again. Right? And so you have happy attackers on all those other servers. So that's with some of the attacks. If you're interested, there are several Black Hat talks you could also watch. I'm not going to play any of them today. I just kept it there if you're interested, and if someone online wants to check it out, you have a look at that. So now with some of the defenses or potential benefits of using SDN to improve security in the network. Right? So this is a slightly longer video. I think we don't need to dim it so much. Let's see.
Hi, I'm
okay. Cool. So this was some of the earlier work done, so 2013. This is by SRI, I think it's Stanford Research Institute. And they've done a lot of work with this particular controller, Floodlight. And they were actually looking at how they could use SDN to make the network more secure. And this is one video that talks about it. So I'm just going to let it play as he has some words.
This demo will explore the potential for an OpenFlow-enabled security service to proactively contain a propagating malware outbreak. To drive the demo, we'll introduce the SpamBot into a host operating within our network. Let's assume that our SpamBot, say the ZBot Trojan, infects our host and then joins one of the vast numbers of the notorious Zeus botnet channels. On this particular channel, our victim is enlisted to join a spam campaign, but as with all self-propagating malware, also searches for other recruits to infect across our network. Unfortunately for the SpamBot, its communications with external SMTP servers, which it needs to blast spam across the internet, also offers a strong detection signal. Bot Hunter is well versed in diagnosing the dialogue patterns of spam bots. Here, we will use OF Bot Hunter, an OpenFlow extension that enables Bot Hunter to insert security mediation logic into SE Floodlight. The blue console shows Bot Hunter's response engine, while the black console shows SE Floodlight's security actuator client. The response engine evaluates new infection profiles generated by Bot Hunter against mediation policies that we specify using an XML configuration file. Bot Hunter itself does not incorporate a native understanding of OpenFlow. Rather, it's an expert at determining when local systems are infected and should be quarantined, as well as tracking those remote systems that are involved in the infection. Once our victim is assigned to a spam campaign, its dialogue pattern is caught by Bot Hunter, and the response engine analyzes the infection profile to determine how best to respond. The response policies are specified in XML and enable the response engine to translate the infection profile into actionable security directives. When it catches our spam client, the response engine immediately forwards a quarantine directive to the security actuator. The security actuator operates as an interpreter, translating the high-level security directives into flow rules that halt or manipulate the malware's ability to communicate or attack others. It receives the quarantine directive and translates it into a series of flow rules designed to isolate the infected spam bot from the network. In effect, the victim client is cut off from any and all communications over the network, with the exception that all of the DNS and web traffic that the host initiates is redirected by the switch into a quarantine notification server. There, our web proxy will respond to all web requests with a notification page, informing the user that the host is now quarantined and to go see the system administrator as soon as possible. Let's illustrate that result here. We'll launch a browser and attempt to connect to a website, say Google, but instead SE Floodlight rewrites the flow, tunneling the request to our quarantine notification server. With a little further forensic investigation, we're able to learn a bit more about the malware that invaded our client. We can take more aggressive steps to monitor for other infected clients that may not have yet revealed themselves. To do this, we'll update Bot Hunter's local DNS blacklist to trigger an infection profile for any other host that performs a lookup to these same Zeus domains. With Bot Hunter now aware of this SpamBot's command and control domains, we can use our response engine to initiate proactive containment, even if the full SpamBot behavior is not observed. For example, later, a second host in our network will initiate a DNS lookup to one of the domains associated with this botnet. When this occurs, Bot Hunter now reacts more aggressively, even if the full SpamBot behavior has not yet been observed. It initiates a full duplex block of the IP address returned by this DNS lookup. It also initiates a deny directive to prevent the host from any further communications to other SMTP servers. It then redirects the host web traffic to the quarantine notice on the notification server. This more limited containment could be applied across hosts on the network indefinitely until the infection is fully removed from the network. For more information.
Yeah. So essentially, the idea of that is to dynamic. Yeah, go ahead.
This for sure sounds like there's a lot of parsing going on.
Yeah, for sure. Who knows? You can probably even compromise OF Bot Hunter, right? I understand that itself is vulnerable, but the point of playing this video was to show you how you can dynamically reprogram, say, forwarding rules or the data plane, and react to certain events that occur, for example. So that's dealing with, say, events that occur in the network. And then you have sort of, I would say, like theoretical work or like verification that you can do now when you have this open flow and the standard match and action paradigm, right? And so just briefly have this person talk about that.
Each year, Microsoft Research hosts
that we have tremendous diversity. Whether it's a Cisco box or an Arista switch, they're all so different. How in the world is a tool industry going to be born? What saves us is that, in essence, there is something in common. Okay, so you already know a router. It just maps a bunch of prefixes to ports. There's another animal called a bridge. It doesn't matter what it is. It takes 48-bit Ethernet addresses and does an exact match on them and maps them to ports. There's another creature called an MPLS switch that uses small integers called labels and goes ahead and maps them to ports and sometimes sort of plays with these labels. And now, while they all look different and they all come from different vendors, fundamentally they all match on some fields and basically do some actions like rewrite headers. Okay? Now that's the essential insight for something called OpenFlow, which you might have heard of, which is a design movement for future routers. But what we'd like to say is that besides it being used prospectively, we can use it retrospectively to understand existing networks by mapping them to this intermediate form to generate tools. Okay, and so that's the essential insight behind this thing called header space. So you start with this router, and it's basically at the low level that Windsurf would see. It's a match and an action, and you do this. But you could think of it a little more abstractly as a header space, and the rule that is matching is a hypercube in this header space. A packet is a point, and what the router is doing is basically mapping points from one space to another, and with that, what happens is the Cisco forwarding table or the bridge spanning tree table now becomes a set of guarded commands in classical Dijkstra notation, where one subspace maps to another in a sequence like that. And if that's the case, and you can compose all these routers to make a network program, the entire network of boxes and fiber optic links becomes a big program. So now you should ask the question, why can't we apply every methodology known to man for programming? Debuggers, static checkers, runtime checkers, you know, specification mining, every idea known in the last 20 years, why can't they be applied here? And that's what's exciting us. All right. So basically, to summarize, the header space framework is going to take all these routers and summarize them by a transfer function that maps sets of headers to sets of headers. So what can you do with that? Well, now you can do symbolic execution. So imagine you want the simplest question, A talking to B. So what you can do is start with the complete space at A, right, which is the entire possible set of packets, and pass it through the transfer function at the first router, and the header space splits up, and you're keeping track of sets, as Sharon said, and now you keep doing that, and finally those spaces sort of move through these transfer functions, and they emerge at B. Okay? And formally, they're just a bunch of compositions and unions. Now, unfortunately, that's not quite enough because the packet could have been rewritten, so you need to do one more step to invert the spaces to figure out which packets A must have sent. So as long as you have a compositional and invertible semantics, all this stuff can be done. And you can do all kinds of other things like waypointing and general questions like this. So, two big takeaways. First, remember that from the point of view of programming languages and model checking, this is just symbolic execution. The real essence here comes in the domain-specific data structures. We don't just use BDDs or throw it into a model checker that can give us big wins. Second, remember, it's abstraction. We've taken all these real boxes and written real parsers into these transfer functions, and now we can stay at this abstract intermediate form that enables tool land.
So essentially, with this video, or at least that work, is probably one of the most cited works in SDN, essentially. Like, now you have OpenFlow, and you can do all this verification. So if you look at a lot of SDN conferences, or at least networking conferences nowadays, you have verification people also in the program committee, because a lot of people are looking to apply, say, model checking and symbolic execution and stuff like that in networking. So that was sort of the point of this video. And then we have, or maybe before I, so what's the mood like with everyone. Should I? It's been about an hour now. Oh, what's going on? It's been about an hour now. You guys can handle another, I don't know, 5-10 more minutes, or we stop. Yeah. Okay. So, or maybe a little more, 15 minutes. You know? So this is another piece of work that I've done with some of my colleagues, and this is again based on malicious switches. And so in this piece of work, we wanted to see how we can use SDN to actually detect, say, malicious behavior by switches, right? And so now, since we have this centralized controller, we have a global view of the network. We know where packets should come from and where they would potentially go to. And we can also sort of peek at the packets a lot as they flow through the network. And so we built this tool, which is sort of inspired by trajectory sampling. Okay. And I'd like to show you a small demo about that. All right, so let's see. So using this tool, we can say, like I mentioned, peek at packets. So we sample packets as they flow. And then based on how we sort of sample packets, we can detect whether a switch along the way actually dropped the packet that was supposed to go from A to B, or whether it sort of injected a packet that was supposed to, injected a packet. So imagine like a TCP injection, like a reset packet. You can switch along the way could simply send a reset and sort of DOS some victim, right? So we've used Onos as a controller, and we did this with a mini-net based on, say, a factory topology or closed topology, right? So this is sort of targeted at our data center network, but it's generally applicable to any kind of network, right? And so quickly want to show you how this works, or at least how we could use this to detect an attack. So we start the controller. I don't know why I'm showing the logs. Okay, so we start a bunch of switches, right? So that's using MiniNet. And we can see all those switches connected to the controller, right? So we need the controller to know about these hosts. And now we just sort of ping from one host to the other. And so now we can see what those flow rules are on the switch. At least that's what I'm going to show now. Right? And so you can see all those sort of flow rules. So if it's this MAC address, this source MAC, this destination MAC, go to this particular port, or go to this table, and then go to another port. Okay, so now this is our sampling, trajectory sampling application that we activate. And then we have like a whole bunch of features that you can use. So we have different ways in which you can actually sample packets. Some things you need to configure based on your network. And we also have this as a multi-threaded application. So you can actually do a lot of detection. You can sort of detect or conduct our analysis in parallel using multiple threads. So we got to enable a few things. This sort of shows our sampling rules. So essentially the idea over, whoops, what was that? Back? Yeah, it could be right. Yeah, so essentially we want to sample packets based on, say, a VLAN tag. We essentially tag packets, And then based on their VLAN tag, we would actually sample packets. So actually, this VLAN tag is actually taken from the TCP checksum. So our idea is to use the checksum field to sample packets. And so that's sort of like a hash of the packet header and payload, and that's sort of uniformly distributed. So it's random in some sense. And so now we start to, we send a packet with that particular VLAN tag. And then we can see how the sampling sort of works, right? So when we send a packet, this is sort of the log that says, hey, I got this packet. I'm doing all this analysis and stuff like that. It's not so important right now. Now, I think the important part comes when we want to detect attacks, right? So that's over here. Okay, just bear with me. Okay, so now the attack is that you have a switch along the path, and that decides to drop packets from, say, A to B. And the idea is to show that using this particular solution, we can actually detect that, right? And so we simply configured the switch to drop packets from that MAC address, right? And so we can see that rule over here. It says drop if it's this source MAC address, right? And so the controller doesn't know about this. So this is sort of like this malicious switch, right? This switch over here. So that's where the packet's going to go from. It's going to get dropped by at 0:21. Right? And so we're going to send that packet. And then we can see here, it throws this error saying, hey, this particular VLAN tag with this source MAC, this destination MAC IP address was dropped between those two switches. And this essentially shows you can detect this attack. You can also do not only drop, but injection as well. So I won't show that right now. I mean, it's sort of the same thing in some sense. Right? So essentially, we leverage the centralized controller and the capability to be able to sample packets throughout the network. And we have this sort of global view from the centralized controller to do something like this, which was really difficult to do back, I mean, with this whole distributed control plane. I don't know. I think I'm going to skip this. Anyone wants to watch this video? This is, again, like this video that, I don't know, it's, I don't know, I'm going to skip it for now. I'll leave it for people if you're interested to watch it offline. It's sort of Ericsson showing off how they're using SDN with 5G. So I'm quickly coming to the end of my talk. So just some sort of resources or info on controllers and switches. If you're ever interested in looking at anything in SDN, have a look at Onos, Open Daylight, and Ryu. These are pretty popular controllers, typically running on some x86 server. There are several switches. So OpenV switch, like I mentioned, is the most popular one, as far as I know. In fact, a lot of people are using, from what I've heard, they use OpenV switch in hardware switches as well. So that's sort of like their OpenFlow agent. And we just don't know about it, that they're actually using OpenV switch in some sense. Then you have all these other big boxes like Cisco Juniper, also Arista. And also a new one is Barefoot Networks. I think they've been active for about a few years now. And you have network cards as well. So in the past, in the recent, I don't know, maybe 3 years or so, you have a NIC multi-core ARM processor in a NIC running OpenV switch. So you have like this super powerful OpenFlow virtual switch running on your network card by Broadcom and Cavium. And then you have a whole bunch of other SDNE cards like Netronome and HCore. And then you have emulators and simulators, so Mininet, which we looked at, and NS3 as well. So like I mentioned, some podcasts. So OVS Orbit is a really cool one. I enjoy that. And then there's Packet Pushers. Anyone listens to Packet Pushers over here? All right, cool. Yeah, so Greg Farrow and some of his colleagues have this pretty cool podcast. I'd suggest to listen to that if you're interested in networking in general. Yeah, more resources, some links. And yeah, that's it. My contact details. Thank you for your attention, and yeah, I'm happy to answer any of your questions if you have any.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for this fantastic talk. So, do we have any questions from the audience? No one. Okay. So, have you? Coming back to protocol parsing stuff,
mm-hmm.
No, protocol parsing is always fun. Have you considered for example, using IPv6 extension headers as an attack vector?
As a target?
They look not promising.
Not sure. So as far as I recall, my colleague did find some parsing issues with, I think not the IPv6 headers, but ICMPv6.
Oh, yeah.
Close. But yeah, that's a good question.
Okay.
So we tried for, so as far as I understand, my colleague Barkova, he ran AFL on OpenVSwitch, the parser logic, and it's kind of exhausted as far as I understand. So whatever vulnerabilities were there have been squeezed out. We just need to wait for more parsing logic. Yeah.
Well, or better fuzzers.
Yeah. Well.
Well, this is at least my theory in regards to TCP dump stuff. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's not open up this list bag.
Okay.
Okay. So, but if there are no more questions, there. Perfect.
It seems to me that most of the issues we saw here were because packets are not forwarded from the, let's say, from some kind of static flow entries inside the middleware boxes, switches, routers, whatever, but because they are sent to the controller and rules are added dynamically.
Mm-hmm.
What speaks against, if you know, I'm coming from the traditional network, so you have a router, you have a switch with this ports on that VLANs and so on. So you could simply transfer that into OpenFlow rules and have it provision it from this central knowledge instance. But of course, you would then have many rules on your devices. But wouldn't that be a good possibility to avoid, for example, sending all your packets to the controller and having vulnerabilities because he's parsing the stuff?
So your question is, what if the packets, if you have, say, rules proactively installed in your switch, so things like teleportation, for example, won't exist, right? Yeah, that's completely true. So it's a question of whether you have those rules in there or not. You need to have, so as far as I understand, you need to have a balance between having a bunch of rules in the switch and reacting to certain events. And it's like a trade-off, typically. You want to be able to handle packets that are flowing through the network versus just keeping rules in there and just waiting for that one packet to come and hit that particular rule.
Any more questions? Okay. Therefore.
Oh.
Awesome.
Speaking of the teleportation attack, the first attack you showed, it worked because you reduced the time it took to send ping packets.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly was the technical reason this happened? Like, what was the bottleneck, or why did this happen?
So the question is, okay, why did we have to send it so fast, in some sense? Well, we could have sent it a little slower. It's just that if I wanted all 10 of those ping requests and replies to come by, I had to send it so fast. I could have just sent like one packet and it would have gone. The reason why I sent it so fast was that there's some processing delay at the controller. So when it receives those, say, ping packets in what's called actually packet ins, it needs to parse those packets and then see, oh, it's from this source to this destination. I need to construct a flow rule and send it to these different switches. And so there's this delay in it computing that and then pushing those sort of rules down to the switches. And so if those rules were installed in the switch, then the packets would actually go through the switch and then not go up through the controller. Does that answer your question?
Anything else? No one? Okay. Right. Awesome.
More like general question again. Do you think it would be, let me begin at the start. Could you say there's software-defined networks and just hardware networks, like the traditional networks? Yeah. Is it like the simple separation? Is it possible to say it's like that?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I would say it's like traditional or the way we used to do networking then and sort of software-defined networks. Why do you ask that?
The question is, will software-defined networks be all around in 50 years and no more traditional?
So, I mean, we can't go away from like hardware packet processing. So we're going to have, we still do, you have hardware-based software-defined, say, routers or switches. So all this packet processing, taking a packet in and sending it out, to do it at line rate, you need hardware. It's just that how are you going to operate, manage, and control these hardware switches? That's sort of this software-defined approach.
And you don't need that different hardware as you have now. You just have the one hardware which can do everything and will be...
So I think some boxes, it needs to be able to, you need to be able to upgrade it and sort of port whatever SDN protocol you want on it. So I can imagine like this old Juniper M40 box, I think won't support it, but the new ones should at least.
More? Okay, I guess. Sure. I guess we're finally through.
Alrighty.
Okay. Then thank you, Kashyap.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your attention. It was a really nice Datengarten. I think we are done. Have a good night and bye.
All right. Thanks.